offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triumph Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I have the pleasure of coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. This is a program where we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse, and we are in the sixth chapter, the chapter which is otherwise called Atma Samyamya Yoga, and that part is precisely what we're talking about. We are in that portion of the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna is preparing the ground for speaking about dhyana, because this chapter is also referred to as Dhyana Yoga. But before we go to what we have for this week's episode, the shlokas that we're going to go through, probably we'll have the time to go through three shlokas like we have on most of the weeks. But before we get to them, let's go through the three shlokas that we went through last time. I'll start with a brief summary, and with that we'll proceed to this week's episode. We went through three verses 3, 4 and 5. Because I played the sixth verse, I'll be replaying it today and we'll continue from there. Verse number 3 had multiple interpretations. We went through all of them, we spoke about them in detail. But one of the final ideas that with which I concluded the discussion on verse number 3 was that an arurukshoho munehe, a sadhaka who wants to ascend the peak of being in yoga. Arurukshoho munehe yogam. And that's what Krishna said in the third verse. To reach that peak, Krishna says, karma is used as a means. So whatever actions one performs, whatever duty one has to perform, be it in the family, be it in one's work, whatever is expected of one, that karma itself becomes the mean for the one who wants to ascend this peak of yoga. Once he or she reaches there, one becomes a yoga rudha who has accomplished that state of yoga. Now this person also continues to perform actions, as Krishna has been telling from the second chapter, that a jnani also performs actions even though he or she does not have a necessity to do it. So when one becomes a yoga rudha, one has ascended that peak of yoga, now this person also continues to perform actions, but shama, or the tranquility or equipoise, becomes the means for the actions that are performed. In the fourth verse, Krishna reiterates the point that he had made about what makes a true yogi. A person who is a sarva sankalpa sannyasi, a renouncer of all sankalpas, thoughts that eventually end up becoming raga and dvesha. He is spoken of as a yoga rudha, one who has attained yoga. And Krishna reminds that that state is reached by one who is not attached to sense objects and karma. And when he says karma, as we had discussed, it means not getting too attached to the actions and the duties one has to perform and the consequences of those actions and duties that one has performed. So one has to, this is something again, as we discussed last time, a repetition of what Krishna has said before, it is not about not wanting any consequences at all. We went through that in detail when we had discussed it, I think in the third or fourth chapter. But not being attached to it, not being overly fixated about the consequences or the rewards that come thereof. The fifth verse is a very interesting one, and this will become the basis for the next few shlokas, and so I will give a more detailed summary on that. In this shloka, it clearly states that you are responsible for your own uplift. You are responsible for your own downfall. Krishna tells Arjuna, you must raise yourself and you must not put yourself down. Uddaret atmana atmanam na atmanam avasadayet, is what Krishna had said in verse number 5. Then he says, you are your own friend, you are your own enemy. Atmaivahi atmano banduhu. Atmaiva ripuratmanaha. And as we had discussed last time, this is a very important statement that Krishna is making. Each one of us is responsible for our own spiritual uplift. And in the path of spirituality, you cannot blame anyone. You cannot hold anyone responsible for either your progress or your stagnation. And when we say a friend or an enemy, a bandhu or a ripu, the one who is taking you closer to God, one who is taking you closer to the goal is your friend, and one who distracts you or impedes this journey towards God is your enemy. So when we say, I am my own enemy, I am my own friend, what does it really mean? Let me give you an example which is probably contextual in the situation we're all in. We all have an immune system in our body, and this immune system protects us from germs and viruses and other attacks on the body. So it is a system that helps me lead a disease-free life. But the same system can begin to harm me and even kill me if it turns against the body cells, and that is what we refer to as an autoimmune disease, right? So there is a certain change in the state of the system that makes what was my friend into an enemy. The fact is, either way, the immune system is doing what it always does, attacking what it thinks are foreign bodies. But a small change in the state, something changes within the system, something goes wrong, and it begins to endanger us. When Krishna says, you are your own enemy, you are your own friend, there is some change in the nature of some of the instruments within that is causing this shift. The same instruments harm and the same instruments serve our interests too. And when we say atmaivahi atmano bandhu, one of the words atma used is to represent body, mind, senses complex, right? We've been speaking about that over the past few weeks. The word atma has three different meanings, just to refresh you. One is the Satchidananda Atman, which is Brahman, which is pure, which is our true self. Then Atma is also used to represent the word self. When I say myself, I do it myself, I am myself. So that small self, what we refer to in English, is also the word Atma is used even for that. The word Atma is also used for the mind. It is also used for the antakarnas. When I say, I'm contemplating myself, or I am going to control myself, we are referring to the body, mind, senses complex. So when I say myself, it is me, the real self, and the body, mind, senses complex. So when I say the self causes harm to the self, it cannot be the Atman which is Brahman. As Krishna has said many times before, the Atman is only a witness. It neither acts, nor does it make somebody else act. It's in a state of changelessness, so it doesn't do anything. So what must be changing in the body, mind, senses part? What must be changing is the body, mind, senses part of the self. So in the next shloka, which I played for you last time, but I promised to play again today and discuss it in detail, Krishna explains in what state the self is an enemy, in what state the self becomes a friend. Again, a very beautiful shloka. So I'll play it again, and then we'll discuss it in detail. I have it rendered here, as always, in the voice of Brother Shyam. We'll listen to it. The meaning that I gave last time was a bit cryptic, but as we discuss today, we will see how beautifully Krishna is introducing some concepts which are fundamental to spirituality here.
Bandhuratmatmanastasya Yenatmaivatmanajitaha Anatmanastu Shatrutve Vartetatmaiva Shatruvat.
So that is the shloka that we went through last time. I'm not reading that meaning again, but we'll discuss about it, and we will see what a beautiful idea that Krishna is conveying through this shloka. As we saw, Krishna explains in what state the body, mind, senses become a friend and in what state they become an enemy. When we were students for the sports meet, we once did a presentation on the ancient martial art form from Kerala, the Kalaripayattu form. I think many of you must be aware of that. There are many weapons that a Kalaripayattu warrior is taught, from the regular sword and the shield, in fact, the long stick, there's a short stick, there's a mace, and many such instruments are learned, apart from hand combat, of course. So when we were making this presentation in front of Swami, we made different groups and we learned, each group learned one weapon, and that was what was displayed in the sports meet before Swami. Among the many weapons, one of the deadliest weapon was the weapon called Urumi. It's a very interesting kind of a contraption, if I could put it that way. Imagine there are about 5 whips put together in one whip. And all these whips are actually made of metal, so they are flexible swords. That is what the Urumi is. It is like, imagine having a sword which is 4 or 5 feet long, and it is not like a straight metal sword, but it is a flexible sword. And there are 5 such flexible swords put together with one handle. And that's what was Urumi, and some of the advanced warriors would use 2 such Urumis simultaneously. Right? And even traditionally, apparently this weapon is one of the weapons that is taught last to the Kalaripayattu warrior. The reason this weapon is the most deadliest among all the other weapons is because it can harm the opponent fatally. There's no doubt about that. That's what weapons are meant to do. But what makes this really lethal is, if one does not have perfect mastery and control over it, it can harm even the person who is using the weapon. And it can harm the one who is wielding the weapon fatally. Our body-mind senses are like this weapon, Urumi. If we don't learn to control it, we will definitely hurt others. There's no doubt about that. If we don't have control over our words, our actions, our temper, we will make the life of everyone around us miserable, right? We have been in that position. We have been in the receiving end and in the end of the person who is troubling everybody else. But the person we spend maximum time with, each one of us, is ourselves, isn't it? And if we don't have mastery over ourselves, we will be hurting ourselves more than anything else. And we will do this in both ways, one directly and the other indirectly. Because one is, we will make our present miserable. If my mind is not under control, I'm going to be restless. I'm not going to have peace of mind. How that precisely happens is, we will talk about it when we discuss the next shloka. But indirectly, also we end up hurting ourselves, because when we harm others, that always comes with consequences, and those consequences will also have to be borne by us. So directly and indirectly, we will be hurting ourselves if this body and mind and the senses are not in control. Or you can understand it based on another analogy, the analogy that we often end up giving, that of driving a car. If you have control over it, you will not hurt others or you will not hurt yourself, and you can use the car to reach the destination. But if you have not mastered the art, then sitting in that and driving, you endanger yourself as much as you endanger others around. So that is the answer. The state of self-control or self-mastery is the state in which we can be our own benefactors. Right? Krishna says, Bandhu Atma Atmanaha Tasya. The self is the friend of the self for him. Yena Atma Eva Atmana Jitaha. For whom the self has been conquered by oneself. So what is that state of mind when, state of self, when one becomes a friend to oneself? Bandhu Atma Atmanaha Tasya. The self is the friend of the self for whom Yena Atma Eva Atmana Jitaha, for whom the self has been conquered by oneself. When I'm in a state of self-control, when I have I have conquered my body, mind and the senses, I will become my own bandhu, or I will help myself progress towards the ultimate goal. Anatmanahatu, but one who has not conquered the self, anatmanah, shatrutve varteta atma eva. The self itself remains in shatrutve. Shatrutva means enmity, right? Shatrutve varteta atma eva. The self itself remains in a state of enmity, shatruvata, like an external enemy. So who is becoming an enemy? Not an external person, not a person from somebody who is coming and attacking us, but we ourselves occupy that state of enmity and become our own enemy if we are an anatmanaha, one who has not conquered the self. So when one is not in control of oneself, then he or she himself stands as an enemy to oneself. So there it is. In the previous shloka, Krishna said, you are your own friend, you are your own foe. Here he describes, when you are your own friend, when you are your own foe. If you have self-control, you can be your own friend. If you lack self-control, you become your own nemesis. Wonderful idea this is being conveyed in these two shlokas. Now, what does having self-control have to do with reaching the goal at all? Right? That's one question that anyone can come up with. The second and third chapter have made it very, very clear that jnana alone can liberate. Actions don't liberate. Emotions don't liberate. You could be a king, you could be a monk, you could be doing a lot of charity. None of that will remove doership. None of that will give you the ultimate. Jnana alone can completely remove doership, right? That's what we have seen in the second and third chapter. Krishna has reiterated that so many times. Then why insist on self-control? I'm not able to wake up early in the morning. I can't sit and meditate for 10 minutes. I can't keep going regularly for bhajans. I don't like to lead a disciplined life. But then I read the Upanishads. I listen to spiritual lectures. I'm always speaking about Advaita. I'm always reading about all these esoteric concepts. Why will I not reach the goal? Right? Why is this self-control, self-discipline and self-mastery so important in the spiritual path? When we say self-control, we mean control of the body, the senses and the mind, right? The knowledge of the self is not going to be in the body or the senses. It is going to be in the mind. The mind is going to have Atma Vidya. So technically speaking, only the mind needs to be in control. But the mind in itself is formless, right? So many times Swami would say this, and he would say it playfully. When you go and tell Swami, you know, how do I control my mind and how do I, my mind is troubling me, Swami will say, where is your mind? How can something that does not even have a form trouble you? Or give your mind to me, I'll control it for you. And, you know, where's your mind? How is it troubling you? All of these things Swami would tell to remind us that the mind does not have a form of its own. So to control the mind, there is no direct method. The access point is through the body and the senses. And the senses, in a way, connect the body with the mind. The outer instruments are connected with the inner instruments. When we say inner instruments, it is the antakarnas. So the indriyas are connected to the antakarna. Indriyas are the outer instruments, the karmendriyas and the jnanendriyas. The antakarna are the inner instruments. And the senses are pretty much like the bridge between the inside world and the outside world. And as we have spoken extensively in the third chapter, all karmas is for what we refer to as antakarna shuddhi. The mind is purified through actions that is performed with the body, albeit in a certain way with a certain attitude, and that is what is karma yoga, and that's what Krishna refers to in the third verse of this chapter too. Karma is the means for reaching the peak of yoga. Swami would give this very beautiful analogy, and I might have mentioned it before. In fact, if you go to today's Science Pious quote, Swami mentions this thing. Swami would say, if you have a pot with water and you want the water in that pot to remain still, then you should first ensure that the pot is not shaken, the pot is not moving from one place to the other. So if you want to control the mind, Swami says, first you should steady the body, right? It's a very simple thing that Swami says here, to start controlling the mind, to start steadying the mind, start by steadying the body. In another discourse, Swami had given some very simple tips to control the senses and eventually control the mind. And one of the points was simple stability in the body. Swami said, when you speak to a person, make eye contact. Don't keep shaking your limbs. Don't keep fiddling with your fingers. Don't keep shaking and twisting and swaying around. Many of us have that habit. So Swami was saying, when you're speaking to somebody, make eye contact, stand still and speak. When you sit, sit steady without constantly changing your position. Then Swami said, when you go to sleep, don't curl up. How these things help in sense and mind control, don't ask me, I really don't know. Swami has said it, so I'm sure it does, right? Swami has given these as tips by which the senses and the mind can be controlled. And you just have to try it out, and you know that it really works. If you have the ability to sit still for some time, I think in many ways Swami taught us all of this. Because when you're sitting in the mandir for so many hours waiting for Swami to come for darshan, we've seen this. Automatically the mind, to a great extent, starts slowing down, starts stilling when you're able to sit still and sit put in one place. Similarly, Swami has on many occasions given techniques to control the senses. One is to understand that everything should have a limit, right? And that limit should not be when the body gives up. If I were to explain that, let's say when I'm eating something, I must stop before my stomach gives up. My stomach should not start saying that I've had enough, it's hurting, stop. I should be able to decide before that happens. Similarly, when I go to sleep, I must wake up before I've completely slept and the body says, I can't sleep anymore, you wake up. Right? Sometimes that's how we wake up. We're just like, can't sleep for a minute more. Instead of that, we should be able to wake up before the body says that I've had enough sleep. So leading a disciplined life with limits, Swami says, is one of the ways the senses can be controlled. Then Swami would say, having higher goals in life as such can help you have control over the body and the senses. In other words, knowing that catering to the senses is not an end in itself. I, of course, feed my body, but I feed my body not to please my tongue. I feed the body because the body needs nourishment to do the work or do karma, right? Similarly, having a comfortable home is not an end in itself, but it's a way in which, way we live is, to live in a comfortable and a clean home helps to lead a healthy life, right? And a healthy life again is needed for higher goals. And in one of Swami's discourses, he mentions this point and, in fact, I was surprised to see that Swami says, taking responsibility for one's own spiritual journey, precisely what Krishna has been telling here, that is a good way of controlling the senses. And if any of you are wondering where I'm pulling out all of these points from, most of these points are from one of Swami's 1990 Sambhukos discourses, the one on the senses. I've forgotten to take the reference, but if you go through the 1990 Sambhukos discourses, you'll find that one of them is about controlling the senses or mastering the senses. In that one discourse, Swami mentions most of these points. Now when we talk about controlling the mind, this is all about more to do with controlling the body and the senses. When we talk about controlling the mind, there's something specific that Krishna mentions in the next shloka. But it's not, of course, anything new, because when you say controlling the mind, sometimes you need to control of the mind even to do wrong things, right? You need mastery of the mind, you need skill of the mind, you need concentration in the mind even to do wrong things. Or if you really look at it, much harm in the world has been done by science, right? Which calls for immense self-discipline and hard work. But when we say mind control, it automatically means even subduing the lower desires of the mind with the higher impulses of the mind. So when we say, yena atma eva atmana jitaha, it also means winning over or conquering the lower mind with the higher mind. Conquering the lower desires and impulses of the mind with nobler impulses. It is then one becomes a friend to oneself. Otherwise, even to be a criminal, let's say a corporate fraudster or an unethical businessman, you need enormous amounts of concentration, skill, and sometimes a lot of patience, right? And sometimes you give up small things in pursuit of larger gains. But any such act is done under the influence of the lower basal mind, right? Krishna is not speaking about such mind and sense control. That is why maybe the play with the word Atma is coming repeatedly, because somewhere that, you know, that overtone of Atma being pure, Atma being Brahman is always in a very subtle manner, in a very subconscious way, it is being inserted through the shlokas. So the ultimate idea is to make the Atma the true ruler of all actions. And when I say Atma here, it is the Atma which is Brahman, right? And maybe that is one of the reasons why the play with the word Atma is constantly being used here. Now, coming to the specific mind control that Krishna speaks about, right? So, till now, whatever we have seen is, it is necessary to control and purify the mind. And for that, it becomes necessary to control the body, and the control of the senses is also necessary. Controlling the body and the senses are things which can be simply done. Spirituality or having a spiritual bent of mind helps in that. But even without that, the body and the senses can be controlled, right? If you're going to an army school, or if you're leading, if you're in a very, very regimental household where everyone is being very strict with you, no one is speaking about any spirituality, still there will be body control, there will be sense control to a greater extent. But when we're talking about mind control, that is where the idea of the spiritual journey comes in. And as I just mentioned, it also means controlling the lower tendencies of the mind with the nobler tendencies of the mind. But there's another way of self-control, mind control, which Krishna speaks about in the next shloka. We'll listen to that. This is shloka number 7 from the 6th chapter. I'll play it for you. I'll give you a brief meaning, and then we will discuss in detail about what Krishna is saying here.
Jitātmanah prashāntasya paramātmā samāhitah śītoṣṇa sukha dukkheṣu tathā mānāpamānayoh.
The self of him who is self-controlled and has attained peace is equally unmoved by heat or cold, pleasure or pain, honor or dishonor. Now, once again, why are we speaking about control? Coming back to that question, I live my life the way I want, but I will read spiritual books. I will listen to all these Gita talks and satsang that you're giving. Why can't I reach the goal? The question that I had asked before, I think I've not sufficiently answered that. The simple answer is, to reach somewhere, to reach a destination that you want to get to, sometimes simply going with the flow is not the best option. Say I'm going in a boat from upstream to downstream, then I really don't need to do anything. I just have to get into a boat and go with the flow. But life as we know it is not like that. Life is like being on a boat in the middle of a wide, vast ocean. That is why we call it samsara sagara, right? Sagara means an ocean. Samsara means the worldly life. So the worldly life is referred to as samsara sagara. I am in the middle of nowhere on this vast ocean. Wherever I see, there is only water. And say there is a certain direction in which I wish to go, and in order to reach land. So I must learn to sail my ship, isn't it? But what are we doing? We end up doing something very, very silly. One, we let the tides take us where they want. So we have traveled for days on end, but there is no guarantee that we are moving towards land. In the same manner, just going the way the world pulls us, we spend many, many lifetimes, but we are stuck where we are. We make no progress really, right? That is why we refer to this as getting caught in this whirlpool of life. Samsara Sagara, you're going round and round, birth to death, death. As Adi Shankara said, Punarapi Jannam, Punarapi Maranam, Punarapi Janani, Jatare Shayanam. You're constantly going through this cycle of being born, entering a womb and living a life and dying. No progress is made because we are going with the flow and the tide probably is going around in circles. What is the next stupid thing that we do? When in the middle of the sea, sometimes the waters are calm. Sometimes the waters are rough. Sometimes the waves throw us up. Sometimes there is a low tide and everything is calm probably. But sitting in the boat, we want only calm waters. We not only have less control over the boat, but whatever little control we end up having, we use it only to go in search of calmer waters. And the problem with that is, it is an ocean and there will always be waves. It is complete stupidity to hope that there will be no big waves and there will be no disturbance in the water. Sometimes there will be a storm. So in wanting only calm waters, we will further get lost and we are signing up for disappointment, as I've said many times before, because there is nothing like a waveless, stormless, calm sea. As Swami would say, life is an interval between pleasure and pain. In this life, we only keep going after pleasurable experiences and we use all our resources in our control just to avoid this pain, like how we all do, right? From education to friends to money to all these resources, we use it only to avoid pain and get more pleasures. We will only be going in circles in the ocean, right? I hope that analogy is making sense. A little bit of control we kind of gather in, as someone would say, that we have been coming again and again and again in this samsara, that we become experts, that by default we learn a little bit of control. As I said, even to do a lot of bad things and do a lot of wrong things, you need certain control over your body and the mind. So we do gain control, but that little control that we have earned, we are only taking our boat of life in search of calmer waters. And that is a stupid thing to do. Because if you have a certain direction to go in, if you have a certain place to reach, the land is in a certain direction, you will have to go in the direction. But if you're learning, if you're using all your control only to search for calmer waters, probably the tide is going to keep you occupied and taking you around in circles, right? The same way we are doing it in real life too. We've earned a little bit of control, anything, you know, if you've gone through schooling for 12 years and you've been in a college and you've got your education or you're doing business, or in fact, even if you're running a household as a mother or a father, you certainly have a certain amount of discipline. You certainly have a certain amount of skill in marshalling your body and your mind. But you use it only in search of, I don't want problems in my life. I want to secure myself from the ups and downs of life. So we are getting caught in this samsara sagara. We are not moving towards the land, moving towards liberation, but we are going around in circles. So what is it that we must do? Firstly, as Swami says, accept that the world has happiness and sadness. This is the first step. Anityam asukam loke, Swami would say the first step is acknowledging, accepting that yes, the world will have ups and downs, to be mentally prepared for it. Secondly, you must learn to maintain the balance of the boat when the boat is being hit by waves, right? Going back to the analogy of trying to sail through the ocean. So if I want to learn that, the best way to learn that is when the waves are hitting the boat, right? How will I learn to maintain balance when being hit by waves if there are no waves around? Because when the waves hit the boat, that is the opportunity I have to learn balance, right? If you see, for instance, if you see these surfers who are very good at, I don't even know the terminologies which goes with that. You have a surfing board and people go through the waves, and it's a very beautiful scene to look at. If you look at these surfers, you know, they probably might learn how to maintain their balance on the surfing board in waters that are calm. But then they go in search of big waves because that is the best way to learn. In the same way, we will look at difficult situations in life as an opportunity to practice and learn balance. So the first step is we will acknowledge that life is full of ups and downs. But when there is a challenge that is approaching us, we will look at it as an opportunity. Can I take this opportunity to learn balance? Or can I take this opportunity to test how much balance I've already learned? And when we slowly start becoming a master, then we will learn the art of riding the wave. You will let the same harsh waves that unsettled you sometime back now carry you closer to your destination. The same failures, the same successes, the same disasters, the same sorrows, the same fame, setbacks will now help you move closer to your goal. For that, the first thing is not be completely inimical to the ups and downs of life, not be averse to them, acknowledge that they are part of life, and then that adventurousness to look forward to them, because only in the wake of challenges I can learn balance. And once that is mastered, now every challenge will become not only an opportunity to learn, but an opportunity to take you closer, right? As if I'm not wrong, it is Khalil Gibran's words who says that and disaster viewed rightly becomes an opportunity for progress, right? Something to that to that meaning, Khalil Gibran says. And that is why this attitude is very important. It's a very important one when we speak of mastering the mind. The mental attitude of equanimity. Krishna has mentioned it so many times already. We are not even halfway through the Bhagavad Gita and Krishna has mentioned it so many times. And this is not going to be the last time we're going to hear Krishna speak about equanimity either. So Krishna speaks of that as being a friendly state of the mind, right? When we said that there is a state of mind which becomes a friend, there is a state of mind which becomes an enemy. So that friendly state of the mind Krishna speaks of in this shloka as jitatmanaha, of the self-controlled, prashantasya, of the peaceful, paramatma, the supreme self, samahitaha, balanced. The last two words can be interpreted in different ways. Two different interpretations are often given, and I think both convey a very interesting meaning. Till now, the word Atma was used to connote self, right? The self, which means body, mind, complex, or whatever I refer to as myself. If you come and ask me, who are you? I'm going to tell you my name. However much I've read the Bhagavad Gita, I've not yet come to the state where I tell you I'm Atman, I'm Brahman, right? So that self is what we are referring to as Atma. But here Krishna specifies as Paramatma. He says, Jitatmanaha Prashantasya Paramatma Samahitaha. So he says Paramatma, the supreme self. So one of the ways of looking at this statement is, for a Jitatma, one who has conquered oneself, one who has won this battle with oneself, one who has become peaceful, Prashantasya, Paramatma Samahitaha. The word Samahitaha can also be translated as established. So in the case of such a person, the self is established as the Paramatma. the Atma that we were talking about till now as the body-mind complex, as the personality, that Atma is established as Paramatma. Right? That is one of the interpretations, and that makes absolute sense because that is one of the goals of the spiritual process. From our idea of ourselves, we marshal ourselves, and this true idea of the self is established. That's the whole goal of this spiritual journey. The other way of explaining this involves splitting the words slightly differently and translating samahitaha to mean composure or tranquility. That's also one of the meanings of the word. So now the statement is jitatmanah prashantasya atma param samahitaha. So instead of paramatma, the param is attached to samahitaha. The one who has conquered oneself and is peaceful, his self attains supreme composure. So this statement or this interpretation is also valid when you say param samahitaha. It is a composure that cannot be challenged by ups and downs in life. And Krishna mentions those ups and downs in the next line. He says, Shitoshna sukha dukkeshu, in cold and heat, pleasure and pain, tatha, as also, mana apamana yoho, in honor and dishonor. Shitoshna sukha dukkeshu. This is a repetition of what Krishna had mentioned, I think, way back in the second chapter. At that time, I discussed how pleasure and pain, sorrow and happiness, must be treated like shitoshnaha, which means cold and heat. Repeating what I'd said then, Swami would say, when the weather is cold, you wear an extra layer of clothing. When the weather is warm, you wear thinner clothes. You don't brood over that change. You just live with it. You find ways of adapting to that. So in the same manner, you acknowledge that in this ocean, there will be calm waters and there will be rough waters. You accept it and you find ways of maintaining your balance. Samahitaha. You find ways to be in that balance no matter whether the waters are rough or calm. The next pair of opposites is a little more tougher to deal with. Krishna says, mana apamana yoho. Maintaining balance in good and bad name. Why is that tougher? Because for a good part of our life, the pursuit of a good name in society is what is used to gain this self-control over oneself. When we were in school, we were never told, don't bother about getting a good name, don't bother about what others think of you, don't bother about what your teachers say about you. No, in fact, we were told, get a good name, right? And that mandate given to us by our parents is what makes us disciplined children. In fact, Swami himself would tell this to his students, I am not interested in marks, ensure that you don't get bad remarks. Or when we were graduating, Swami would invariably tell the graduating batch, get a good name for yourself, get a good name for your parents, get a good name for Swami and the institution. So in trying to maintain a good reputation in society, we end up becoming a jitatmanaha, or one who has self-control. But at one point, after a certain point in the journey, you don't need other people's validation as a tool to be good. You must transcend that need for name and fame also, and that is what Krishna is mentioning here. And that is sometimes not very easy, right? The mind calls for a separate training to view mana and apamana as the same. But it is a very, very essential training of the mind. The reason why this is very essential in the spiritual path is because when say people attack you, when people praise you, when people ridicule or celebrate you, what are they remarking about? The remark is always only about the body, mind, senses complex, isn't it? Not who you really are. Let us say at the end of this program you come and tell me that I spoke really well. Your presentation was very good. The explanation that you gave was very good. What are you doing? You're praising the mind. You probably are praising my karmendriyas of speech. Maybe you're praising my buddhi, my memory possibly. Or let us say you come and tell me at the end of the show that your show was quite horrible. Again, you're critiquing either my way of talking, the lack of clarity in thought, which is not who I really am. All of this is in the body, is in the senses, is in the mind, is in the instruments that I hold, not in the real self that I am, isn't it? So whether it is praise or ridicule, it is only addressed to the body-mind complex. Though trying to earn a good name helps in controlling this body-mind complex, that's what Krishna has been speaking about. Atma eva atmana jitaha. But eventually, we are to transcend this body and mind, isn't it? And for that, seeing as same both appreciation and criticism, good and bad name, becomes a very, very important step. But for this, merely control and discipline is not enough. The next more important step becomes very critical. And Krishna continues the explanation in the next shloka. We'll listen to shloka number 8. We'll discuss as much as we can, and the remaining, if there is any, we'll continue it for the next week. So first we'll listen to shloka number 8. I'll give you a brief meaning, and then we'll discuss and conclude with that.
Jnana vijnana triptatma kutastho vijitendriyah yukta ityuchyate yogi samaloshtrashmakanchanah.
One whose mind is satisfied with knowledge and realization, who is unmoved, who has his organs under control, is said to be self-absorbed. The yogi treats equally a lump of earth, a stone, and gold. So that is the 8th verse. So now Krishna starts speaking about a jnani. Till now it was about being a master of oneself, and by being a master of oneself, you become your own friend in the path. It's like, it's something like rock climbing, right? You have to lift yourself with your own might. Nobody is going to come and help you with that. This is a process that prepares the mind. What we are referring to as body control, self-control, discipline, and all of that is what prepares the mind. As we have discussed many times before, all these are preparatory steps of the mind which enables it to be ready to receive that jnana. And as the Brahma Sutras very beautifully declared, Atatho Brahma Jignasa. After all this, then one is prepared for the real pursuit of Brahman or Brahma Jignasa. And that Brahman is attained only through knowledge, something that I alluded to some time back. Krishna speaks about that here, but he has a very interesting element. But before that, he again mentions the quality of self-mastery. He says, Vijitendriyaha, who has conquered the senses, Kutastaha, who is unshaken, which means, that's why I said this is a reference to the jnani. The jnani has mastered the senses, and he is in a state where he is established in that. He is going to be unshaken in that state. He or she is perfectly a master of that state. I think some of us are, we have mastery of the mind. Today we have it, tomorrow we are not too sure, right? When we say kutastaha vijitendriyaha, it means one who is unshaken in that state of being a master of oneself. And then Krishna says, or this is how the verse starts actually, jnana vijnana triptatma, one who is satisfied with jnana and vijnana. Triptatma means a person who is self-satisfied, who is self-contained, who does not need anything to be happy, or is not, this is something which, a terminology or a concept which is used many times even before by Krishna to explain the state of a jnani, right? There's nothing to achieve, there's nothing to accomplish. So triptatma. But this tripti or this self-satisfaction, how does it come? Jnana vijnana triptatma. That tripti is coming from jnana and vijnana. This usage is very important when Krishna says jnana and vijnana. What is vijnana? The interesting thing is, till now we've spoken about jnana and we always have praised jnana. In fact, I think the fifth chapter and the fourth chapter had verses which were in speaking in glowing terms about jnana. But interestingly, apparently, when you use jnana vijnana together, vijnana sometimes is spoken of as being a little higher than jnana itself. Jnana, when spoken of alone, is whatever we have been speaking about, the knowledge that one is the supreme. But jnana vijnana, when you say, jnana is knowledge, but vijnana is actually a step which is higher than knowledge, so to say. What is that vijnana? Jnana is the knowledge that oneself is the supreme. And one of the ways in which Adi Shankara himself describes it is, you know, it is a knowledge that is given to you from the scriptures. The guru tells you, or you read it in the Upanishads, or through the process of listening or receiving from the masters, you have got this knowledge that you are not the body, you are not the senses. But vijnana, Adi Shankara says, is when through the process of shravana, manana and nididhyasana, this knowledge becomes a part of yourself. So vijnana is spoken of as a state where this jnana becomes an experience of your own and you are living it in your own unique way sometimes, right? That's why Krishna had said, you know, once one becomes a jnani, after that, whether one becomes a monk or whether one remains like Janaka, a king, that's completely up to that individual, right? The options available for a jnani are plenty. Right, so jnana and vijnana is that. Jnana is that knowledge that we've been speaking about. Vijnana is when that jnana becomes a practical manifestation in that person's life. In fact, there's a very beautiful quote. I don't recall in which of the episodes, but in one of the afternoon satsangs, we had referred to this quote. These are words of Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, where he speaks about jnana and vijnana. I'll just read out this quote for you and we will discuss a little about what are these two, how are these two different. He says, and I quote, "The jnani gives up his identification with worldly things, discriminating not this, not this, neti, neti. Only then can he realize Brahman. It is like reaching the roof of a house by leaving the steps one by one. But the vijnani, who is more intimately acquainted with Brahman, realizes something more. The vijnani realizes that the steps are made of the same material as the roof, bricks, lime and brick dust. That which is intuitively realized as Brahman through the eliminating process of neti neti is then found to have become the universe and all its living beings. The vijnani sees that the reality which is nirguna, without attributes, is also saguna with attributes." End of quote. A very, very beautiful concept or way by which this is described, right? We have always spoken of this process of neti neti, and that's what they say. When you ask this question of who am I, you move from the idea that I am this body, you move from that idea to I am not this mind, I am not the senses, I am not this personality, I am not the jiva which has traveled through many bodies and many personalities. You go on saying, I am not this, I am not this, neti, 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 and you eventually reach, you remove all anatma and you finally reach that understanding of the atma. That is jnana, right? But wonderfully and very beautifully, Ramakrishna Paramahamsa explains. But once that experience has been attained, the vijnani is one who says that not this becomes not only this, which means everything now becomes the same God. right? Just like how, you know, when we are talking about the spiritual process, we say that from being a worldly person to being a jignasa, to becoming a karma yogi, to becoming a jnani, right? So you are discarding each one of those steps. That's what he beautifully described about scaling the steps, going from one step to the other. You are discarding one step behind saying that I don't want to be a worldly person, I want to be a karma yogi, I'm not just a karma yogi, I become a jnani. But once you reach that state, once it becomes an experience, you look back and say, the worldly person is also God. The person who is, person who is struggling on the spiritual path is also God. The person who has no idea about the spiritual path is also God. The jnani is also God, right? That's again a beautiful idea that Krishna makes a reference to in the previous chapter also. So when you talk about jnana vijnana, it means knowing something and then that knowledge becoming completely part of yours, right? And specifically Krishna mentions this jnana vijnana because, as I said, at this point he's speaking about somebody who has transcended that self-control. Now I've got complete control over my body and the senses, but the goal will not be reached unless one becomes a jnana vijnana triptatma. One is self-contained, right? Without self-satisfaction. That's why Swami would often say that self-confidence, then you have self-satisfaction, and self-satisfaction leads to self-sacrifice, and then eventually have self-realization. Self-satisfaction is what leads you to self-sacrifice. When you are satisfied, you let go of all the sense objects, you let go of all mana and apamana, as Krishna said in the previous one, right? So a very, very beautiful way, very gradually Krishna speaks about what it takes to reach that goal. In the sense, first he says, take responsibility, don't blame anybody else. You are your own friend, you are your own enemy. And then he says, when is it that you're your friend, when is it that you're your enemy? When you have control over yourself, you become your friend. What is that control over yourself? He says, first have control over the body, have control over the senses, and then have control over the mind. And in control of the mind, there are different levels. You have higher goals, lower goals, both of that is in the mind. Let the higher goals master the lower nature of the mind. And then he says, you push your limits to the point where you look at mana and apamana, good name, bad name, ridicule, criticism and praise and applause and accolades, everything as being equal. That calls for a little stepping up of this process. And then he says, eventually, jnana vijnana triptatma, then you strive for the satisfaction that is born out of this knowledge that you're already complete, and that becomes a practice, right? And that is the thing which Krishna mentions in the first line of this particular shloka. And then of course he says, such a person becomes a yukta. So yukta is one who has already reached that state. Ityuchyate yogi. Such a person is referred to as a yogi, as a person who has scaled that peak and reached that state of yoga. And he says, very beautifully, he says, samaloshtashma kanchanaha, one to whom a lump of earth, a stone and gold are all the same, right? The way one looks at the material, and that's what I said of the nature of a vijnana, right? A vijnani looks at all of these things as being equally part and parcel of that Brahman, and nothing is more precious than the other, or nothing is less valuable than the other. That state of equanimity. Probably we'll end with this. We'll conclude here, dear listeners. When I come back next week, maybe I'll take it off from here. We'll speak a little more of the shloka and then take it on from there. So this is the eighth shloka. We went through 6, 7, and 8 here. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. Do join me again next week for the resumption of this, for the Gita pilgrimage that we've been going through for these many, many months. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. Till I meet you all next week, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.